Hello, everyone. Welcome to Ash's World. We have a very special guest today. We have James L. Swenson. How are you doing today?
Just great, thank you.
Wonderful. So, the first question is the toughest question, and then it gets easy as we go along. My first question is, how would you briefly describe yourself in any way you see fit?
I'm a lawyer, filmmaker, and author, and I'm interested in stories that involve overnight change in history. Some people have kidded me and said, all your books about death and murder and blood. That's true and it's false. My books are about moments of instant change, overnight change in American history. So I've written about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln in my book, Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer. I've written about the Kennedy assassination. I've written about the chase for Jefferson Davis at the end of the Civil War. I've written about the last days and death of Martin Luther King Jr. And so all these stories are united by this theme of constant and surprising and unexpected change in American history, where the world can change overnight. That's what I'm really interested in.
I love that. I love that. So what I want to talk about today mainly is your book, your latest book, The Deerfield Massacre, A Surprise Attack, A Forced March, and The Fight for Survival in Early America. So the title kind of gives away certain things there of what's going to happen. It's very well written. It's brilliantly written. It's kind of like a story. It feels like fiction, but it's based on actual facts. And we get a lot of information also afterwards what happens. But my first question is this then. What happened on February 29th, 1704, leap day of all days, in Deerfield, Massachusetts? And you explained it brilliantly in the book. So I want you to present it to the audience today.
Yes. Well, in a nutshell, what happened on February 29th, 1704, was that a raiding party of more than 300 Indians, and the tribes included the Mohawks, the Hurons, the Abnakis, the Iroquois, 350 French officers and militia and their Indian allies, probably about 300 Indians and maybe 50 French, marched 300 miles through the middle of the winter through snow and ice from Canada, or New France as it was called then, to Deerfield, Massachusetts, a small village, remote village on the northwestern edge of the New England settlement. About 300 people lived in Deerfield. It was a time of conflict between France in the United States, or the America, over England, over the ownership and control of all of North America. And so the purpose of this march was to raid Deerfield by surprise in the middle of the night and kill as many people as they could and capture many, because the Indians wanted hostages and captives also, one, to ransom them, to earn money, to trade them for other prisoners, but also in a practice called the Morning Wars, Mourning, they wanted to capture boys and girls and adopt them into the Indian tribes to replace members who've been killed in battle or who had died. And so that's what happened. They crept over a snowdrift, ascended above the 10-foot palisade protecting the fort, dropped in by surprise, burned most of the houses, burned them all before they left town, killed 50 people in the streets, men, women, children. Reverend John Williams is a very key figure in my book. He's one of the great heroes of the story. When the Indians attacked him, they murdered two of his children on his doorstep, a 6-week-old baby and a small boy. And then they murdered the nanny who cared for these children. And then they burned houses. People were killed in their cellars. They were smothered to death. They were burned to death. They were killed by tomahawks, war clubs. They were shot. And so then, after the raid was completed, early in the morning, they gathered 112 captives and began a march back to Canada of 300 people through the snow and ice. And during that journey, it was one of the greatest ordeals in early American history. 20 people were slaughtered along the way on the march to Canada. Those who couldn't keep up, pregnant women, women who had just given birth. In fact, William's own wife had given birth 6 weeks earlier. She was killed with a tomahawk strike because she fell into an icy river, couldn't keep up. She was killed immediately. And that happened to many people on the journey to Canada. Then, after being captive for up to 1,000 days, Williams and many of the captains returned home to Deerfield. And Williams himself lived for 25 years and became one of the greatest heroes of early America.
Yeah, wonderful. And so the way you describe it too, Deerfield is a small town. You give us the prehistory of the town before it gets to the main event. And I love that because it gives us the context and the background. And this was just a small town. This were just farmers. These were just people living their ordinary lives. And they did not expect they had heard probably of it, but they did not expect a full-scale attack. Is that correct?
Correct. Sadly, they let down their guard because it was the middle of winter. And so they felt, well, we've gotten through fall safely. The Indians and French didn't come. So we're safe until spring comes, which turned out not to be true. It was ingenious of the French and the natives to attack in the middle of winter in deep snow because they knew the people would not be expecting them to come. They should have known better because Deerfield was a very dangerous place to live. It began in King Philip's War in 1675. There was a war between the colonies and Indians led by Metacomet, who the Americans called King Philip. And it was the bloodiest war in American history for the population and the number of casualties. And Deerfield experienced something called the Bloody Brook Massacre in 1675, when the townspeople from Deerfield were transporting carts of grain to supply soldiers fighting King Philip's War. About 70 teamsters and militiamen were going on a short trip on an ox cart to a neighboring village. They didn't realize that 800 to 1,000 Indians were waiting to ambush them. They didn't stand a chance. And then, to make matters worse, as they're crossing a brook, there's a huge canopy of lush, delicious grapes hanging above them. And they laid down their weapons to pick the grapes and eat them. And Cotton Mather, one of the spiritual leaders of New England later, said, "Dear and deadly grapes, they proved to them." He was chastising them, mocking them for their foolishness. So the Indians attacked and they slaughtered these people. And then for the next 25 years, from 1675 till 1704, Indian raids were frequent. People would vanish from the fields and never be seen again. People would be taken captive. Men and women would be scalped and killed in their fields. And so Deerfields is a very dangerous place to live in the late 1600s and early 1700s. And so there's this whole climate of fear and violence and mystery that really haunted Deerfield for a quarter century before the raid of 1704.
I just can't imagine the lifestyle of the times, and you're describing it, but that kind of paranoia you have that you can't walk outside because walk away from your town without protection because you can be attacked. The people could get abducted, children and women could get abducted and so on. So it's this fear that they lived in, and we don't hear a lot about that. Our impression of it is that yeah, they lived there and everything was fine, but here you're in constant threat, also attacks, and the attacks were different. They were not used to those kind of ambushes in terms of war style, and so that was very tough life that they had, in addition to the poverty and trying to survive and cultivating food and the harvest and so on, there's that constant threat going around.
Yes, and there was another form of threat too. This was 75 years before the American Revolution. So this was not the pretty revolutionary age of beautiful houses, streets of Boston, Philadelphia. This was a dangerous, frightening time, not just because of Indian attack, that was important. Also, fear of the supernatural, witchcraft, superstition. The Salem witchcraft trials happened only a few years before the Deerfield Massacre. And people believed in witchcraft. To them, it was real. 20 people in Salem were executed because they're accused of being witches. And so there was a constant fear of superstition. In fact, there's a famous relic. The only relic that survives from the Deerfield Massacre of 1704 is this huge door called the Old Indian Door, which was the front door of the John Sheldon House, which came under furious attack the night of the raid. You can visit that door today at the Pocumpic Valley Memorial Museum in Deerfield, Massachusetts. The door has dozens of tomahawk and axe gashes in the door. They tried to chop it down. They tried to burn it down. They tried to use brute force to push through it. They did cut a hole through it, and they thrust a musket barrel through that hole and fired it wildly. And it happened, the bullet happened to strike and kill a woman. The door was never breached. Unfortunately, a person inside that house during the attack got afraid, snuck out a back door, a smaller door. The Indians found it and came in and overwhelmed the house. But that door really sits as a memento today. It really, to the early colonists, it represented a barrier between civilization, the danger of the wilderness, the sinister forest, and civilization and Puritan society. So that's a great relic that represents that fear. And in fact, also, a horseshoe hung above that door. That was not a good luck symbol. No. It was a protection because the legend was a witch could not pass under iron, which meant if that, as long as that horseshoe was up, a witch couldn't walk into that house. And then also we discovered recently on the inner latch of the door and the bolt, carved hex marks carved into the iron latch as to keep witches out. And so it was a time when people were terrified. They were isolated. It was not the pretty New England of the American Revolution. This was a much earlier time. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, none of those founders had even been born. They wouldn't have recognized Deerfield. It was a remote, frightening, and dangerous place.
And so in a way, it puts it also in the context of what happened. They saw it as God's punishment in many ways for their sins. And so that was their perception. And I found there's so many fascinating tidbits about the windows. The windows are smaller because windows glass is expensive, but also so that for protection, so people can't get in. So I just love those kind of bits of knowledge that is thrown in there. And finally, I want to see the importance of preserving history. And so, and you mentioned that Deerfield, that's actually the only thing that has survived, like from that time period. And I find that very sad that we're losing these relics of history that of the past.
Well, in fact, a building called the Old Indian House, which was the John Sheldon House, which had the old Indian door in front of it, that building survived until the 1840s. And it motivated the first effort in America, as far as I can tell, of historic preservation. This predated the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, which saved Mount Vernon, which was in disrepair at the time. So in the late 1840s, a town committee tried to get contributions to save this old Indian house because the owner wanted to tear it down and build a new house. And they sent out a circular and they had newspaper articles. But Deerfield was not mature enough to realize how important it was to preserve some of these houses and relics and architecture. And so photographers rushed there to take two daguerreotypes of the house to preserve how it looked. And artists came and painted paintings of it, but the house was torn down. Some of the timbers were saved, but the house was torn down. And so Deerfield had a chance in the late 1840s to save the only surviving building from the raid of 1704. That house was built in the late 1600s, and it was built very strongly with thick walls and brick in between the wood. And so, unfortunately, the only thing that was saved from that house was the door. And Deerfield even almost lost the door. In the 1860s, it was sold to a collector. And then the people in Deerfield were so upset, and they said, "We got to get our door back." And they wrote to the guy who bought it and begged to have it returned. And then he agreed. He had paid $100 for the door, which is a pittance. And even at that time, the door is worth thousands of dollars. They wrote to him, and then he said, "All right, you can have your door back. Just give me the $100 I paid for it." And they wrote to him and said, "Oh, we can't afford it. We don't have the money." And they're lucky that he allowed them some time to gather the $100 and buy the door back. And then they got it back, and they had a parade to celebrate the door. They almost treated it like a living character, like a human. And then they put it in a barn. Then they started in a hotel. The hotel caught fire and burned down. And it's only because a few people, including a descendant of one of the very people who was killed in the raid of 1704, rushed into the burning hotel, grabbed the door, and ran out with it and saved it, which is why we can see it today, 320 years later, in this museum in Deerfield.
But the good news is in 1962, I think it was, it Deerfield has become a National Historic Landmark. So that is good. There is some movement to protect it. And so I want to also look at what happened to Rebel John Williams, and especially his daughter Eunice Williams. And I find that very touching, very moving, where what happened to her? And you explained it much better than I would.
Well, at the time of the raid, Eunice was 7 years old. She was one of John Williams' several children. Two were murdered the night of the raid. His son Stephen was taken captive with him, and Eunice was taken captive by a Mohawk warrior. And she was a prime target for adoption into the tribe. She was the perfect age to be turned into a member of the Mohawk tribe. And of course, her mother was dead. Her siblings were dead, and she was kept separate from her father during captivity. They weren't living together. And so during this time, it was easy and natural to start forgetting how to speak English, to learn the Mohawk language. Jesuit priests were there working with the French militia, and the Jesuits were trying to convert as many people to Catholicism from Puritanism. We think of that now in an abstract way, but that was intense a combat as between, I liken it to the Cold War, the 1950s, democracy versus communism and Marxism. People believed passionately in these ideological issues and defending them and fighting for them. And so the religious war of early New England between Catholic priests and Puritan ministers was intense. And so they just didn't want to. The Indians mostly wanted to adopt them into their tribes, but the French wanted to convert them to the Catholic faith. And in fact, there's a sad anecdote in John Williams' book, which he wrote, The Redeemed Captive, when he returned home to Deerfield after his captivity. She said, "Father, they're trying to make me say my prayers in Latin. Will that hurt my soul?" And so she was alone. She was dressed as an Indian. She was trained to speak the Mohawk language, and eventually she became one. She married an Indian, and though John Williams, his lifelong dream and hope was to get her to return home, he survived the Deerfield Massacre by 25 years, and she never wanted to come home because she had been converted into the Mohawk tribe and to the Catholic faith. And so it was one of the saddest things for John Williams. He could never, his little girl never came home.
But she did much later after his death, right? So, and I find that also very moving, where you have the people who were involved in this on both sides getting together in the same place. And I just can't imagine how it's like connecting everything, how everything is really interconnected there, and how you have a mixing here of the blood of cultures of one side and the other side getting together and trying to find peace among this traumatic, most horrible experience that they've had. And
Well, many descendants are still alive today. Many descendants of the people who were taken captive, and then who remained in Canada. Some of the men married French women. Some of the girls married French men or Indian warriors of the tribes. And so today, this blood runs through the veins of many people still alive today. Now living in Canada, mostly in Canada, and some of them still they come to Deerfield. They visit Deerfield. They visit this historic place. It's interesting. Even the use of the word massacre is interesting, because for the first 100 years, the survivors did not call it a massacre. The French didn't. The Indians didn't. They called it the raid, the attack, the mischief. They never called it a massacre. It was not until 1804, the 100th anniversary, the town minister gave a very anti-Indian sermon, calling it a brutal, vicious massacre by savages. And then later, during the colonial revival of the 1800s, that came to the fore. People were celebrating the colonial forebears, pewter, silver, early American arts. It was a resistance movement against the industrialization of the modern age. And as part of this colonial revival, the idea that this was a cruel massacre by savages became part of the common popular culture. Indian imagery was appropriated. Deerfield had pageants were descendants of the people who had been in the raid, dressed as their colonial ancestors, and reenacted the raid. It's the only town I know that started to celebrate and reenact a disaster, an attack. I don't know of no other place in America that began to celebrate its defeat. And today, it's so interesting because now there's a move afoot, which I applaud very much, because the Native American voices had been so erased from the story. But now it's very important to include them in the story. And so reenactments have taken place more recently. There have been symposiums to study these things. And so I think it's very important that the voices and perspectives of the Indians and their descendants who had participated in the raid are now taken account.
Yeah, and I love how you talk also about history, and in terms of what history is, it's not just what happened, but also how the story of what happened is told, the way it's told there. And even in today's time, when we are what's happening on, how do we see things, how do we tell things? And that is so important, and how sometimes we have to go back and fix things that we the way it was told was not complete. Again, as you're saying, it's one perspective of adding the other perspective to find a more balanced view of it.
Yeah, my book really has three, maybe three parts. First, it's an action adventure thriller
Yes.
about colonial warfare, the Bloody Buck Massacre, the Deerfield Massacre, the decades of raids and danger and violence and fear and superstition. That's a big part of the book. And just like my book Manhunt was an action adventure thriller. Then part of the book is also about the myth and memory of what happened. How we remember something is as important in many ways as what happened, because myth and memory can change the story, can emphasize things that were not important, can de-emphasize things that were important. And so the way Deerfield has remembered this, essentially the massacre became the core of the tourist industry for Deerfield. Drew people to the town, and it encouraged historic preservation. And so I'm fascinated by the action adventure story, which is crucial, the March of the Captives to Canada, which is sad and frightening and violent, and then the return, the redemption of the survivors back to Deerfield. It's really a three-part story of battle and blood, of an action and adventure, and then myth and memory, and then how we remember it today. One of my favorite souvenirs that people have made. People have made in the 1990s, a company made a John Williams
I was going
action
to talk
figure.
about that. Yes.
And in a blister pack, in this cardboard and plastic covered blister pack, it's not just for Reverend Williams. He's lifting a musket, he's ready for action. He's packaged with the Mohawk warrior who captured him and his family. And it's so funny. I wonder what Reverend Williams would have thought of hundreds of years later, finding himself as a toy action figure.
After reading your book, I really want to see the reenactments. Are they still going on? Do they still have that where they
Well,
represent what was going on?
usually every 4 years around the anniversary of the attack. And this year was leap year, 2024. Some people come down from Canada. They're dressed either as French militia, or many of them are dressed as Mohawk or Huron or Iroquois warriors. And it's a frightening sight because last time I witnessed this, there were maybe 10 or 15 reenactors. And of course, a lot of the public comes and visits, and they reenact the attack, and they bring muskets. And the most ferocious weapon of the New England frontier is what I think is the war club, a carved wooden ball-headed club. Essentially, you'd use it like a baseball bat. You'd hit someone in the head with it. But it was beautifully balanced, elegantly designed, and it has tremendous hitting power. Many times New Englanders have written, he was knocked in the head. And that means that one person wielding this war club, smash it. You could fracture the skull. You could kill someone with one blow of the war club. And so a lot of the people representing the tribes were walking through Deerfield carrying not tomahawks, scalping knives, war clubs. And I just imagine, and I read about this in the book, imagine the number of people we see at a reenactment multiplied to 350 of them. You can see why the townspeople of Deerfield did not have a chance to resist this overwhelming attack.
I also mentioned that the war club is a weapon of choice of yours. Do you have
Yeah.
one?
No, I've held one in my hands at the museum building of historic Deerfield, and I swung it through the air, and only then did I realize what a powerful and dangerous weapon it is.
Oh, that's amazing to actually have the artifacts and see it. And so again, as you're saying, we read about it, it's like, well, it's just a war club. But when you actually hold it and swing it, you just say, oh my God, like this is
Yeah.
what they used.
Well, I illustrate one of these war clubs in my book. It's from the probably the late 1600s, and I illustrate one in the book. And I also have an engraving of an Indian chief holding a war club, and that illustration and that engraving really suggests what an important this weapon was to them.
Now, you also have the 12-day chase for Lincoln's Killer, which is the Apple TV series. So how is that experience going of having your best-selling book to be represented on television? How does that make you feel?
Well, that was great. Recently, Apple premiered the first two episodes. It's a seven-part series, 7 hours. And it's really about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln by John Wilkes Booth, and then the end of the Civil War, and the attempt to capture Booth, and the aftermath of all that story. And there are a couple of great heroes in that. Of course, one is Abraham Lincoln, because we shoot a lot of Abraham Lincoln through flashbacks. The assassination happens early in the series, but there are many great flashbacks that show the relationship between Abraham Lincoln and his war captain, Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, who Lincoln nicknamed Mars, his god of war. Lincoln and Stanton had an extremely close relationship. Stanton helped him win the Civil War. Lincoln once said, "Stanton is the rock upon which the waves of rebellion crash and are broken. Without him, I could not survive." And so much of the series, of course, there's action, adventure, the assassination, John Wilkes Booth, the hunt for him. Much of the series is also the close, even loving relationship between Abraham Lincoln and Edwin Stanton, and how the assassination of the president just crushed him. Because remember, at the end of the war, Stanton had to finish the war. Lee had surrendered to Grant at Appomattox, but the war was not over. There were Confederate armies west of the Mississippi and in Texas. Confederate army under Joe Johnston in North Carolina was still there. He hadn't surrendered yet. So Stanton not only had to win and conclude the Civil War, he had to investigate the murder of Lincoln. He had to organize the manhunt for John Wilkes Booth. Then he had to win the war. Then he had to organize the massive funeral tribute to Lincoln that took him across the country in a 1,000-mile-plus-long funeral journey through all the great cities of the North. And in each of these cities, Lincoln's coffin was open. People viewed Lincoln's corpse. A million people saw the dead Abraham Lincoln travel through America on a train. And 100,000 children saw the body of Abraham Lincoln pass through their town. Because to the people of the North, it wasn't just Lincoln coming home in that train. It was every one of the men lost in the Civil War. Yeah. To women, it was their husbands, their fathers, their brothers, their lovers, their siblings. And so it was deeply emotional, and it affected Stanton very profoundly. And so he's one of the great unsung heroes in American history. So the series really reveals that too. So it's very exciting. Of course, Stanton is played by Hamish Linklater. Sorry, Lincoln is played by Hamish Linklater. Stanton was played by Tobias Menzies, the star of Outlander, The Crown, and other things. And Patton Oswalt, the comedian, is one of the detectives hunting for John Wilkes Booth, and he's great at that. Lily Taylor plays Mary Lincoln. Lovie Smith plays one of the women who was enslaved and then works for Dr. Samuel Ludd, the man who treated Booth's leg when he jumped off from Lincoln's box to the stage at Ford's Theater. And so it's a great cast, and I really enjoy it.
Sounds fascinating.
I've seen it 5 times because I was one of the executive producers and on set in Savannah where we filmed a lot of it. And so I don't get tired of it. I've seen it 5 times now.
Now, 2 years from now, it's going to be America 250, and you are involved in that. So what would you say about that?
Well, yes. 4th of July 2026 is officially the 250th birthday of the United States. And so we're still in the planning stages, doing a lot to plan how to celebrate this, because this should be a national celebration, a national commemoration. And I think it's just going to be great.
I'm fascinated by the founding fathers and what they created. And I don't think they get enough credit because this the American experiment of really inspiring the world. And so, and the link between Jefferson and also with the French Revolution, where he was actively involved. So not just one revolution, but two in the world. And he was an ambassador in Paris at the time, helping them. And the French also helping the Americans to survive and then getting into debt. So there's like so much like intricacies that are involved. And
yes,
in that process, yeah,
it's probably true that without the help of France, America might not have won the Revolutionary War. The French fleet arrived just in time, French troops arrived just in time, and French spiritual and propaganda helped win the war too. And so France was just indispensable in winning the American Revolution. In fact, one of the mottos of the American soldiers who went to Europe in World War I to help France survive the attacks by Germany. The motto of the American soldiers was Lafayette, we are here. Because Lafayette was one of the great French leaders who helped America win the Revolutionary War. And so America thought it felt a debt to France, you know.
Yeah, and so it was the French that also attacked Deerfield. So it's not just good or bad on one side. So it's really complicated. And I think a lot of people are missing out on that when you just see one side of things. And I would actually recommend something that I've done is a DNA test where I found out about my own ancestors. And there's always an element of surprise there. It's like, oh my God, this is like more complex than I thought.
Well, I have to ask you, what surprises did you learn from taking the DNA test and the ancestors?
I found that I was partly Jewish, which because I was born in Iran. So a lot of the things that was surprising, my wife found out that she's Mexican, but she was partly African. I also am partly Chinese, which again, I would have never guessed. And we know that these are more and more accurate nowadays. So I think everybody should take them and then, you know, realize how connected we are with each other.
I do think it's a good idea, but you're right to point out the irony. France fomented the attack on Deerfield in 1704. And then France and England were at war for decades over control of the North American continent. Then, after the French and Indian War of the 1750s and early 1760s, essentially, the French were thrown back to Canada and they lost North America. Then, not many decades later, France joins us to help us win the American Revolution. It's fascinating.
And also they give the Statue of Liberty.
Yes. It's so interesting how people forget what the Statue of Liberty was for. People think of the Statue of Liberty as an immigration statue. It was created by France to honor America for its 100th anniversary in 1876. And so only later was that poem by Emma Lazarus attached to the Statue of Liberty later, the bring us your poor, tired, huddled masses. And so people have forgotten the original purpose of the Statue of Liberty was a gift from the people of France to the people of the United States to celebrate our 100th anniversary.
Yeah, and so when we look also in terms of the French Revolution, they got rid of the king and got an emperor instead, which is a bit worse in that sense. And also how somebody like Napoleon reinstated slavery, which I find horrifying, especially after the effect, like reinstating, bringing it in again. And we don't hear that. So it's really like so complex. And that makes this field of history so fascinating as so much to unearth.
And I'm very interested in the history of Haiti and the Dominican Republic. And remember, there was a slave uprising in Haiti, a violent slave uprising. And France was thrown out of Haiti. But then France came back and essentially tried to reinstitute slavery and took over Haiti again. And then the American forces have occupied Haiti at different periods of its history. Marines were sent there and we occupied the country for a time. So Haiti is a very war-torn country with French history, American history, African history, and very violent history. It's just in that one island. Think of all that's happened.
Exactly. And so, what's next for you? Do you have any projects or books here specifically in mind or
Well,
in?
I'm hoping to develop the Deerfield Massacre story into a film or a
Wonderful.
television series, because it involves so many great stories from early American history. And it's a great story. It's a story of battle and blood, of endurance and survival, of faith and family, of testing and living and returning and being redeemed. I think it's a natural for the screen. So I'm hoping to develop the Deerfield story into a film or a television project.
It's a great book. It's a wonderful book. And so definitely would be great on the screen too. So I want to remind everyone, so James L. Swanson, you are a historian and author, but also filmmaker, as you said. Your book that we talked about mainly today was The Deerfield Massacre, A Surprise Attack, A Forced March, and The Fight for Survival in Early America. And it's been just wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much for being on Rash as
Thanks for
well.
having me. I so appreciate it. Thank you.